Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch here, as you always are on Fridays, 11 in the morning Pacific Standard Time on the west coast of the USA, wherever you're at. Thank you for joining me around the world. As always, I have a fabulous guest today, and probably one of the most talked about subjects that I encounter in my private practice office, which is how to deal with grief. How does grief affect us? How to get through? Do we ever get through grief? And what happens to our brains, actually? What's going on with me? Why can't I get over this? When can I get over this? How long am I going to suppress this grief? And on and on. So, you know, it's a very interesting subject because we don't have all the tools. And some of the old information that we received about the grieving stages we go through from Kubler-Ross, you know, had certain stages. And indeed, we do go through various stages, not necessarily in a specific order, but we all have our own way of grieving. And we all have our own way of reacting to it within our brains as well, which to me is fascinating. Because when we understand what's going on, then we can really sort of get through the process, I think, a little gentler. Doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get over our grieving right away, but it just helps us understand what's going on. So my guest is amazing. She has written a book. It's called Before and After Loss, A Neurologist's Perspective on Loss, Grief, and Our Brain. Her name is Dr. Lisa Shulman. She's a medical doctor, and she's also a professor of neurology at the University of Maryland. And she's the author or editor of numerous books on neurologic disorders, including something else that is fascinating to me. And I know many of you out there have had relatives or are dealing with it yourself, Parkinson's disease, A Complete Guide for Patients and Families. And that is her third edition. So she is an expert on that as well. Well, she's a neurologist, of course, Dr. Lisa Shulman. And today we're going to be talking about her latest book about before and after loss. And actually, I just want to introduce this a little bit more. Dr. Lisa Shulman had continually studied and observed and dealt with chronic illness over decades as a neurologist. But her knowledge didn't really prepare her for the experience of profound loss that she had in 2011. And I'm going to let her explain that to you a little bit here on the air. And that way you'll get yourself familiar with what she had gone through and possibly learn how to get through your own loss, no matter what kind of loss you experience. So let's pull her up right now. Dr. Shulman, thank you so much for being here on the couch with me.
And thank you so much for inviting me here.
Oh, this was a terrific book. One of the best I've read, actually, on coping with loss, grief, and what's actually going on from a neurological point of view when we do respond to this kind of thing.
Well, you know, as your opening suggested, it's not that I think any of us think we're prepared for the loss of people that are so close to us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly I thought as a practicing neurologist dealing with serious and even life-threatening illnesses that I would know more than most. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't my experience. I found myself just blown away by the emotional of loss.
Sure.
I think that, I'm going to take a bit of an exception with all due respect about the characterization of stages of grief and the way many of us have been trained and taught about the process mm-hmm. because that wasn't my experience.
Wow.
And if anything, you know, what I had imagined mm-hmm. Grief to be about, mm-hmm. you know, I sort of envisioned an extreme sorrow
right.
and sadness and depression. But, you know, that wasn't the problem.
Yes.
The problem that I was confronting was an extraordinary disorientation and loss of bearings.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I've heard that, you know, many times before with people. There is a disorientation. It's sort of like our mind doesn't really know how to handle a sudden loss. And maybe you can share with listeners what your experience was back in 2011.
Well, yeah. You know, I think that you know, I think there is a distinct difference between depression and grief, and
right.
that grief comes closer to emotional trauma than depression.
Right.
And, you know, I was, as I said already, experiencing a great difficulty
sure.
for quite a long time.
Sure.
And it led me to start to do my own research at some point about mm-hmm. how these experiences had impacted the mind, the brain, and the body, because although I was quite functional, you know, back to work and doing all the usual stuff,
right.
I sensed that there were periods of time where I wasn't myself and I was in a daze. Ultimately, after
yeah.
doing a lot of reading,
right.
I came to the conclusion that what I had never reckoned with is that it's possible for emotional trauma to cause injury to the brain and body.
And that is so fascinating because, and I want to get into that in just a bit, it makes a lot of sense. You know, we think of emotional trauma as head injuries, you know.
Right.
But it goes far beyond that, as you have researched. And back in 2011, I know your husband and colleague, Dr. William Viner, was diagnosed with cancer, and he passed mm-hmm. away 17 months later. And again, you talked about your process of grief, which was very different. You were overcome and utterly unmoored, and you were just grappling, as it says here, as I was reading more about it, with a sense of alienation from your very self. And we do that for protection services, I know. So can you talk a little bit more about the difference between, say, a concussion that someone suffers when they have head injury, you know, trauma to the head, and what you call emotional traumatic brain injury?
Yeah, I think that's it's a very interesting time right now because your field of psychology, the field of psychiatry, and the field of neurology are ever increasingly just simply merging.
Right.
Because we understand more and more over time how our emotional experiences are all representations of neurologic function.
Right.
Very hard to believe, right? You know.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, the fact is it's true. And if you go back classically to how I was taught as a neurologist, the concept of brain injury was traumatic brain injury based on a physical blow to the head.
Yes.
And even the idea of concussion is more recently folded into the concept of TBI or traumatic brain injury mm-hmm. because, you know, in concussion, on a sports field,
right.
people experience a blow to the head, they are dazed, they may even have a loss of consciousness, but then they recover quickly,
right.
usually.
Right.
And people used to think that was benign.
Yes, exactly.
Used to send them out on the field,
right.
you know,
just
afterwards.
Going out there and, yes, boy, it's so
scary. Now
we
know that, in fact, is a form mm-hmm. of brain injury, although we can't see it on fancy imaging scans like MRIs.
Yes. Yes,
I think it's the same thing with emotional trauma, mm-hmm. that, you know, when you have a serious emotional trauma, and, you know, we're talking about grief
right.
here, but it could be, there's so many forms of serious trauma in our lives, whether
sure.
it's a wrenching divorce or a sudden loss of one's career or mm-hmm. occupation,
mm-hmm.
all of these things are highly traumatic.
Sure.
And as you suggested, our brains are hardwired to help us survive that.
Mm-hmm. Sure are.
And to protect us. And the way that is done is to actually create the subconscious. It's fascinating, is able to create a filter that sets a threshold and literally protects us from disturbing emotions and memories that we're not yet ready to handle.
Right. Isn't that wonderful how our brains are devised that way for
and
us to survive?
That is wonderful. But the result of that rewiring of the brain in order to accommodate that after trauma is a feeling of being dazed and disoriented. And when I saw that and when I began to appreciate that, it was a key moment in my own process of healing.
Sure. I bet. Exactly. When we understand what's going on. And most people aren't neurologists who have studied this. So thank goodness for your book. By the way, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle, and my special guest is Dr. Lisa Shulman. She's a medical doctor. She's actually a neurologist. She's written her latest book here. It's called Before and After Loss, a neurologist's perspective on loss, grief, and our brain. And that's exactly what it's about. The premise of the book is basically that grieving is a protective process, which is an evolutionary adaptation to promote survival and preserve our function in the face of emotional trauma. But again, we were just talking about how we do that and how our brains sort of handle that, Dr. Shulman. But the negative side is we do repress a lot of that in order to cope and function, right?
Well, I think you're right about that. And so, I'm sure you've talked with other guests about the concept of neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity simply means the remodeling and rewiring of the brain in response to experience. I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, when we have bad experiences, the remodeling is that kind of protective response that you just described.
Yes.
But the key thing is that neuroplasticity can continue to evolve. And if we understand the process, we can be proactive and take steps to move in a more positive, healthy direction with remodeling and neuroplasticity.
That's such good news to hear because, you know, what most of it, I guess the layperson's information is that, well, we have neuroplasticity up until a certain age, and our brains usually stop, say, growing to their full potential at age 25. And after that, boy, we're on our own. But the good news is, you know, there are changes that occur in the brain in terms of neuroplasticity after we have trauma of any kind in our lives emotionally. So
no, there is definitely good news. I mean, you can teach an old dog new tricks. It's very true. And you know, actually, as we age, speaking generally, as we age, we actually have just a natural aging process. There's a loss of neurons, of nerve cells. But yet, for a long time, we are able to continue to function at just as high level, sometimes even higher as we age. Because of these sort of workarounds due to neuroplasticity.
Right, exactly. So what happens here in terms of our brains when we do experience severe emotional pain? Do we shut down certain centers? Do we shut down, you know, the emotion part of our brain? Or do we? Is there a subconscious, Dr. Shulman, that we so-called store, you know, these experiences in? Or what is your experience with that?
Well, I do believe that the memories and emotions we're not yet prepared to face are stored in our subconscious. And, you know, I, you know, worked hard on this myself by my own steps that I found most helpful to me in terms of my own restoration and recovery,
yes,
were to keep a journal during the day and a dream journal based on my dreams at night. Mm. And that dream journal in particular, at first, I mean, most people after a severe loss or emotional trauma have more active dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I was in that category, and I was having these bizarre dreams. They all seemed strange and weird and probably not meaningful to me, but at some point I just thought, I'm going to start writing this stuff down.
Yes.
And what I found over time, and there's a whole chapter in the,
yes,
book on dreams and dream interpretation,
mm-hmm,
I was amazed over time that what seemed entirely bizarre in terms of the symbols,
right,
over time I was able to make more sense out of it and see a sequence that was making more sense. And I think that is, I believe, and others have said this, that is exactly the memories and emotions that are suppressed and that can't be normally consolidated. In other words, linked,
right,
to past memories.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. So what's going on in our dreams? You know, you had just mentioned they offer hidden messages with symbols and meanings that we should really think about. So is that, are we in a REM stage when we're dreaming? And is that allowing us to sort of heal and work through issues? Is that why we dream, do you suppose?
Well, I mean, the purpose of dreaming is, dreams are extremely vital,
mm-hmm,
to our health.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the times where, oftentimes it's described as that we are in the midst of our rapid eye movement or REM sleep,
mm-hmm,
that we are filing away, mm-hmm, all of our new experiences, mm-hmm, in different files that link to our previous experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, you can call up an experience and say, oh, this was like when I ate at that restaurant with these people, because it's all,
right,
organized,
yes,
in the mind.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the very disturbing, traumatic memories, you know, they don't fit with past experience.
Right.
In fact, like you said before, mm-hmm, you can't explain them. You can't integrate them into your life story.
True. True. Exactly.
And they just continue to roil around in the subconscious mind, and it's a lot of work, quite frankly.
Yes.
To reconnect to them.
Yes, it is. What was your experience, if you don't mind sharing that with us? I know it's in your book, but in allowing yourself to reconnect with your loss and some of your feelings that you had shoved down?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that this is precisely what you're asking, but I think it's an important moment to share. And, you know, for a very long time, I was completely dumbfounded. I,
yes,
was in a daze. I didn't get it. I was trying my best.
Right.
I had one pivotal experience that just simply turned me around.
Yes.
And I describe that in the book. And that experience came out of the blue because it was one evening I was cooking dinner,
mm-hmm,
after work, and I decided I would open a recipe book to a recipe that my husband Bill and I had made in the past. And
yes,
when I opened the book, I saw a message on the recipe page that my husband had scribbled on the page.
Yes.
Because we had a kind of a ritual or tradition where we wrote recipe notes,
mm-hmm,
next to the recipes as we made them.
Right.
But I had forgotten that was there, so I opened it up,
uh-huh,
and saw it suddenly, and it was very emotionally poignant because it was a message from the day he had found out the diagnosis.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
And so I was standing there, and when I read his message, it really emotionally struck me.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
Then what happened, it's hard to explain even. But I sort of just was standing there and lost track of time.
Yes.
And then when I sort of became more aware again, I was literally standing in the kitchen holding a knife, and I was looking around and thinking, what am I doing?
Yes.
Because I had been completely taken away from what I'd been involved with.
Yes.
And for a moment, I thought, when I saw the recipe book, it's sort of like I was able to put it together again.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the first time, Michelle, and it was a very pivotal moment, but the first time I said, that is what's been happening to me.
Wow. That's amazing.
When things are very emotional, mm-hmm. I have these moments where I lose a little time because, and why is that? Why is that? That was my key recognition that the mind is capable of blocking things out when mm-hmm. it's too much for us.
Yes, that is so true. Thank you so much, Dr. Shulman, for sharing that experience with us. It is mind-boggling, but good for you that you were able to focus on that and just be totally unaware of what you were doing in the now, and your mind was trying to process, oh my goodness, this is what was said the day before he was diagnosed. So that is amazing.
Right. So I think that, you know, was what set me on the path mm-hmm. to understand, since nothing like that had previously happened to me before,
mm-hmm.
The experience of loss, and this set me on the path to understand what had happened to cause that kind of reaction by my mind and brain.
Isn't that interesting? Do you suppose, and this is just sort of off point here, but in our everyday lives, that in order to cope just with stressors at work, in our relationship situations, any family problems or any other issues that we're dealing with, not even severe losses, do we sort of go on automatic pilot so we don't have to feel things? Do you suppose that's why so many people are workaholics these days? And I don't know. What do you think?
No, I mean, it is an interesting thought. I mean, what it really makes me think about is that our world is so incredibly overstimulating and busy that it doesn't lend itself to take the time that's necessary to be mindful mm-hmm. and to connect with the reason why any particular life experience is troubling and is giving us challenge.
Mm-hmm. It sure does make a lot of sense. In case you just tuned in, guys, you're on the couch here with Dr. Michelle and my special guest, Dr. Lisa Shulman. She's a medical doctor, neurologist specifically. Her latest book is called Before and After Loss, A Neurologist's Perspective on Loss, Grief, and Our Brain. And Dr. Shulman had her own loss with her husband. She really observed what we've been talking about, in case you just tuned in, how she processed that loss and how interesting it was to her, and how actually her book sort of came out of that, and what she, in her being a neurologist, studied about the brain and how we can possibly heal on some level from traumatic loss, which does change brain chemistry, no matter what kind of trauma we have in our lives. And I think loss is probably the most profound, but I think, you know, whether it's experiencing an abusive home growing up, losing a job, having to move abruptly, you know, any kind of trauma like that, our brains do change. I have a question. It's just my own. This is my own personal indulgence here, Dr. Shulman. So do you suppose, you know, that's what knocks our chemicals out? And they categorize adjustment disorders, adjusting to environmental stressors. So people get on antidepressants or, you know, some kind of mood stabilizers, that kind of thing. Do you believe that these traumatic experiences can create mental disorders that, you know, are troublesome the rest of our lives?
Well, I think that's been rather clearly shown. You know, basically, I think that the, I mean, a couple, two things I want to mention. Mm-hmm. One is that there's a difference between depression and grief.
Yes.
And the medications that are available, you know, are good for some people, not 100% respond, mm-hmm. but many people respond in terms of depression or anxiety. But studies show that grief does not usually respond to these kinds of medications.
Mm-hmm.
So to heal and recover from a grief requires insight and requires this kind of, I mean, healing actually, it's interesting. Healing will occur with time.
Yes.
But to grow, to be all the wiser, to be able to use the experience that was so difficult for us in a constructive and healthy way in our future life, that requires insight. That
yes.
post-traumatic growth requires insight.
Yes. So what type of insight do we need to have in order to recover slowly? Not quickly.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's, you know, look, grief and loss, traumatic loss is really harrowing and so very painful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no glossing over how difficult it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's certainly there's a sense of incredible loss and loneliness. And some of that does improve with time, but it's a matter of figuring out ways to integrate this difficult experience into our lives and continuing our bonds in a new way with our loved ones.
Yes.
You know, I think that really is very much against and counter to anybody's idea of closure or just simply moving on.
Sure, sure, exactly. So there aren't really per se stages because everyone grieves differently. Everyone has, I mean, we all may experience what's the acronym DABDA or whatever, the denial and anger and bargaining and depression and eventually some type of acceptance, like you said, that requires insight, that requires, you know, self-healing. They're not necessarily a correct way to grieve then. There's no specific amount of time that's normal.
That's a really important point. You know, that I think people who are following traumatic loss of any type, especially grief, though, are sometimes measuring themselves against some cultural expectation mm-hmm. of what grief is like.
Right.
And looking at the calendar and thinking, well, maybe I should be at this point now, you know, in my progress.
Right.
But that just does such a disservice to each of us because, you know, the severity of the trauma, the traumatic, the emotional trauma is related to the personal meaning of the event.
Mm.
And, you know, none of us can judge that for somebody else.
Yes, it's so true.
You know, I mean, you know, it's impossible to understand the meaning in anybody's lives of a particular loss. So I think that we should, like, be very forgiving of ourselves and mm-hmm. take pressure off of ourselves and say, I'm going to allow myself to heal at my own pace.
Yes, exactly. And I think what you just said, I was going to bring that up. One of the most common things, you know, I tell my patients in my psychological practice is, please be gentle on yourself. Please be kind. Don't beat yourself up for, you know, just breaking out and crying at work and not knowing why or how that happened, or for suppressing it for a long period of time and not even feeling it, or just, you know, being like a robot and focusing on other things that really, in the scheme of life, don't matter. You know, just be gentle on yourself and your process and not worry about what others are thinking about you when you're still going through this. Try to just...
No, that's so true. I mean, don't measure yourself by anybody else's yardstick.
Oh, boy, is that true. So,
you know, one thing I just also wanted to raise is that there is profound similarities with all forms of emotional trauma, including what we know about post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
And a lot of, you know, there's been a whole lot more studies, I think, of that, and more discussion about the therapies. And I was kind of amazed that while I was doing my own studies and coming to conclusions based on other people's work mm-hmm. about the best way to reconnect with these suppressed memories of grief. So then I was surprised to find that in the world of treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, the very same thing was what had been discovered as being the most effective therapy. Because mm-hmm. right now, as I'm sure you know, what is found to be particularly effective in PTSD is exposing the individual to their traumatic memories mm-hmm. over time, mm-hmm. as opposed to distraction or moving on. Mm-hmm. So it just shows you the similarities in our responses and our healing process from various forms of emotional trauma.
Mm, it sure does. And it exactly. And it's just sort of exposure and then response prevention. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think that it's exposure because of what we talked about before mm-hmm. about the mind's capacity
yes.
to suppress
yes.
this information
yes. Yes.
and suppress it from our awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And that inability to access that information is a recurring problem in terms of
sure.
disturbing dreams by night
mm. yes.
and intrusive thoughts and ruminations by day, mm-hmm. just like the flashbacks mm-hmm. of PTSD.
Yep. Yes. And to be gentle with yourself and allow those to come as they may. And just know, like you said, having insight and know what's going on. So you talk about being mindful and choosing activities in order to foster growth after, you know, losing someone, feeling this trauma. So let's talk about some of the activities, and you talk about some of the contemplative practices, journaling, spirituality, two traditional therapeutic options. So maybe we can talk a little bit more about the spirituality that you bring up in your book. How can that help folks get through losses?
Yeah, I think that the various tools and steps that we take are as individual as we all are. You know, we're all going to have our own style.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for some people, it will be spiritual or religious practices that puts them in the best space to reconnect with these suppressed emotions mm-hmm. and memories.
Yes.
But for another person, it may be that they are extremely artistic and that rather than journaling as I did, mm-hmm. they may be able to connect with these thoughts and memories by artistic practices, mm-hmm. you know, drawing
yes.
or painting,
sure.
photography.
Mm-hmm.
And for the next person, it could be that they are they find themselves most comforted by being in the outdoors
yes.
and being close to nature.
Right.
So it's another example where we need to try to be in touch with ourselves. Sometimes we don't even know what brings us comfort.
Sure, sure. And we don't have to really push ourselves or suffer trying to figure out what to do. Sometimes we just need to relax and allow. And, you know, if we practice a certain type of meditation, whatever that is to, you know, whatever style that is, or mm-hmm. just resting your mind, allowing yourself to have some downtime and just not beat yourself up again about how, oh my goodness, how am I supposed to feel? I'm numb. I'm supposed to be crying every day. I'm supposed to be feeling this loss and showing everyone else that I'm suffering, but I can't get in touch with that. I don't know what's going on, you know, and it sometimes it's just relaxing the mind, meditating, being mindful about where you are at, and you know, again, just doing relaxation exercises, you know, those are really good, and imagery as well. And you have a wonderful chapter here on the how-to of journaling, and I know this helps so many people. to sort of, like you said, there's all sorts of creative ways that we can, you know, express our feelings and grief. But journaling is wonderful. And I know you had this experience as well. But can you talk a little bit more?
I had never, you know, been into journaling before. Many people are. Yeah. And when I was probably at my lowest point, I was searching for some path forward.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really, you know, part of the flip side of being cognizant of what is comforting is also to be cognizant of what is not comforting.
Yes, exactly.
And a lot of the things that people might think would be the path forward for me just really weren't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I, at some point, seized on putting my mind to journaling.
Yes.
And I did find, as I was writing out what was so painful, what was really I was ruminating about every day,
mm-hmm.
I saw that it was, in fact, kind of like taking the pressure off.
Yes.
And so that was reinforcing. I continued to do it. What I learned over time, which many others have seen,
mm-hmm.
is that journaling has some many unique properties,
mm-hmm.
because where else can we communicate to ourselves?
Yes.
In a way that we're not speaking to somebody else. We don't have to worry about how it lands with somebody else. Are they going to be judgmental? Do we have to be careful about how we say it?
Yes.
And then on top of that, a week later, a month later, and a year later, we can go back and read our own words.
Yes.
And have new insights based on the time that's gone by.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, was really a continually active process of getting back in touch with these thoughts that I had suppressed.
Yes. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, because it is beautiful. We do get stuck in the rumination sometimes, and, you know, but really expressive writing disrupts their hold on us, as you say, you know, in your book, which is, I think it's most helpful. And I do encourage a lot of people to use journaling, you know, especially when they're having some kind of trauma or suppressing feelings, or it's not, don't judge yourself as a writer. And you have to determine also, I share this with patients as well, what do you want your journal to do for you? You know,
mm-hmm.
and as you suggest, which is lovely, do you want it to preserve memories of sacred times, or try to tame those emotions, or help you learn from what happened, or, you know, focus the mind and organize your thoughts? You have all these wonderful suggestions. What do we want to do in our journaling? Bringing suppressed thoughts in the open, or helping us reboot, restore, and find balance. And I think journaling can do all of that, actually. There's no rules, right?
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's for you. And,
yes.
you know, so there were all these months and years where I was simply writing for myself. And then I was researching the brain aspects of trauma. And that was for myself. And then at some point I was doing so much writing, I looked at it and I thought, this is probably a book.
Yes, <You know? laughs> yes.
But it all started very spontaneously in the way you described, to try to get back in touch with my own thoughts.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely. You also talk about a religious or spiritual tradition, and how that can be a vital pathway to help us, you know, deal with deep emotions. Can you share a little bit more?
Hello?
Oh, I'm right here. I'm sorry.
Okay. I very much, you know, agree. And I am very familiar with how, for some people, their faith is their greatest source of comfort,
mm-hmm.
that it continually makes them feel safe.
Yes.
And that's, you know, one can't overstate how important that is.
It really is. And individuals don't have to subscribe per se to a particular religion. It's wonderful if they do, and they do have, you know, belief systems and within their religion about the afterlife or praying, you know, and getting healed from that. But sometimes people can go, you know, and find, of course, that's the beauty of the internet sometimes, you know, you can find out about certain spiritual pathways that might help you. Or again, meditation to me is not a spiritual thing. It's more of a mindful practice. But I mean, you can get in touch with your own, you know, feelings. Some thoughts can come to you. I think much in the way that when you were reading what your husband had written in the book in the kitchen, mm-hmm. we are allowing insights to come to us when we are in a meditative state. So,
you know, one of the, you know, surprising things is that when we're having difficulties like this, some of the things that we imagine are going to be comforting to us don't measure up.
Yes.
It's hard to predict that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for some people, they might think that, you know, getting together with old friends mm-hmm. Is going to be a path forward.
Right.
But it might not be. A support group, perhaps, for some people is very helpful, but if for another person, it just simply will not help them.
Yes.
So I think that it's... the hard part very often is looking in a mirror and being honest with yourself and mm-hmm. saying, you know, it may be against conventional wisdom, but mm-hmm. these things aren't being helpful and I have to find my own way.
Mm-hmm. That's beautifully said. You know, I hear from a lot of people that if they allow the grief to pass in its own way, if through time they feel less depressed or have, you know, less symptoms, fewer symptoms in response to that, that they're not doing justice to that person who's passed. They feel guilty, like they should always, maybe on some level, they should be hanging on always to that person. What would you say to these clients who might kind of express that it's a little scary to let go?
Well, I think that's a very important point that, it is painful to think about that idea of letting go, of so-called closure, of moving on with your life.
Mm-hmm.
I found it very comforting to instead approach it that my bond with my husband would go on throughout my life.
Yes.
And I think for everyone, that our bonds with our loved ones are deeply meaningful and impact our life forever.
Yes.
And so that's part of the challenge. Part of the challenge for all of us is to find a path so that we can integrate these past experiences and the heritage of our loved ones, and that we are applying it in our daily life.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking personally again, I have found the lessons from these experiences and from what I learned from my relationship with my husband to be something that I can apply on a daily basis, whether it's with my friendships, with my colleagues, and in particular with my patients.
Sure. It really makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much for writing this book. This is one of the top grief books. I would definitely suggest that everybody out there get a hold of. It's called Before and After Loss, A Neurologist's Perspective on Loss, Grief, and Our Brain. So many wonderful tools in here. And of course, coming from Dr. Lisa Shulman, who is a neurologist herself, and also who had experienced a loss, major loss in her life, you know, writes all about the different aspects of what to expect to go through in your life, how to process it, how to heal emotionally, what to expect, and what is really going on with our brains. And thank you so much, Dr. Shulman, again, for this gift that you've given us here, and also for being with me on the show today.
And thank you for the privilege of having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it really has. What is the best way that people can find out more about you and get your book, Dr. Shulman?
Well, the book is available on Amazon.
Great.
Or on the site of Johns Hopkins University Press.
Perfect.
And if you can, at any bookstore, you can ask them to purchase it for you.
That's right. They sure can. All right. Dr. Shulman, thank you so much again. Take good care of yourself. I appreciate your book and for you sharing your stories.
Thanks again.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All right, guys. It is, you know, it's a difficult subject, but it is in our lives every day. And we don't have to have an emotional loss or a physical loss of someone passing. It can be all sorts of loss, you know, and how we deal with it, how we grieve, and how to take care of ourselves and really understand what's going on and not beat ourselves up. Hey, if you just tuned in, by the way, all the information on Dr. Lisa Shulman and her latest book will be up on the archives a little bit later today. And you can listen to the show again, download it or replay it. Very easy to do. Thanks for listening, guys. As I always do say, take good care of yourselves first. And then you'll be great for other people, and that's the way it works in the world. This is Dr. Michelle Cohen. Take good care. Bye-bye now.
Got you on my mind again tonight. Seeing flashing rays of colored light.